Welcome to The Scrub Life, a podcast for and about the incredible profession of surgical technology. I'm Chris Blevins, and our mission at The Scrub Life is to educate the public about surgical technology. Each episode dives into the wonderful world of surgery, where we inform and hopefully entertain our listeners while interviewing amazing individuals within the field and presenting the hot topics everyone wants to know more about. We've now partnered with the Association of Surgical Technologists to help us expand our conversations, bolster our engagement, and bring further awareness to the surgical technology profession. CSTs are an integral part of the sterile team that cares for patients in the operating room. Learn more about this exciting field, the immense effort that goes into educating future CSTs, and how you too can become a ninja of the OR. Now, without further ado, here's the latest episode of the Scrub Life Podcast. Hello, everyone out there in the internet cloud. Thank you again for joining us for another episode of the Scrub Life Podcast. Today, I have someone who is so incredibly passionate about, wait for it, eye surgery, ophthalmologic surgery, which I think is so cool because it's one of those genres of surgery that either totally love or you run from. I can't wait for you guys to meet her. And so let's begin. Katie Mayo, hi, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
It's definitely my pleasure. I want to just get started with a little bit about you personally. I love getting to know the person behind the mask because nobody ever knows that part about us. So I don't know, what do you want to share about yourself with the listeners?
My name is Katie Mayo. I am 37 years old. I am a single mom of a 19-year-old boy. I have been doing eye surgery for 15 years now, and I also rescue and foster, well, I foster rescue puppies, and I just love to work, and I love my job, and just try to live my life every day to the best ability I can.
That is awesome. I want to hear more about how you got involved in rescuing these puppies, because I'm going to share with everybody out there, like, we, right before we just got started, your dog is in labor, right?
She is. She is my sweet Molly. She's 10 or 11, maybe more. So no idea what's going to happen and how many and what they're going to look like. So I'm super excited and nervous.
You know, as a female, I feel so deeply for this dog. Like, where's her epidural? Where's her?
Right. I'm like, I can't give you anything. I'm so sorry.
And 11, don't they say that dogs age, is it like 3 years for every human year? Like, have you ever
heard
that?
Seven.
Is it seven? Oh God.
Yeah, seven.
So she's like a geriatric woman in labor right now.
Well, we think she's only about a year and a half. So, she's more around like 12.
So. Oh, geez. Either way.
But either way, she's going to do great. And hopefully we have lots of little puppies later and just going to be excited.
Then we'll see. How fun. Yeah. I always love to hear how people found our profession to begin with, because as our goal here at the podcast is to teach people about the world of surgical technology, most people fall into it almost accidentally, I think.
Correct.
Unless you have some relationship outside of that. So just tell me how you found the field and what school was like and kind of that route.
Okay. Well, I had no idea what a scrub tech was or what the position was, had never heard of it in my life. You always hear about nurses and doctors and the typical medical professions such as that, but never a surgical tech. And I have always been a worker. I've always had two or three jobs since I was 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And I actually randomly had a friend I went to high school with. She worked at a prominent eye practice here where I live in Warner Robins, Georgia. And she called me one day and she's like, hey, do you want to come work with us? And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't do medical. And she said, well, I think you'd be good. I think you just come up here. They have some positions in the surgery department. Mm-hmm. And the job was actually for a surgical counselor. So counseling patients after the doctor sees them, telling them about their procedure, signing their consent, things like that.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? I'm going to just see what it is. I'm always the type of person that I'm curious and I want to go see and find out. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I'll do something else.
Yeah. Like, why the hell not? Just say yes.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Just say yes. That's what I tell people. The worst thing people can say is no, but if you never try, you'll never know. Right.
Exactly.
So I go, I take the job. It was great. I loved my boss, or who was going to be my boss. She had a great outlook and personality. Her name was Michelle. She's still a good friend to this day.
Awesome.
So go get hired on. The practice is a extremely busy practice. So I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. And at first it was super overwhelming. And I am kind of an outspoken person anyway. So I'm a question asker. So yeah. There would be things where patients would come out from seeing the doctor, reading the charts, and I'm asking questions because I just want to understand more so I can fully counsel the patient and really understand what I'm telling them. Because that's how I would want to be treated if I was on the other end of that. The surgeon one day, his name's Dr. Johnny Gayton. He's very well known in the ophthalmic world. He's like, you ever thought about working in surgery? Because he had his own surgery center attached to his practice.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. And he's like, well, I think you'd be great. I think you should come over here. We'll just, I'll train you on the job. I'm like, okay, sure. Why not? So go over there. At that point, he was doing 45, 50 cases a day out of two rooms. It's very, very fast paced, but I was super intrigued and thought it was super cool. So as soon as I started learning the first day or two, really, mm-hmm. I kind of just knew. I was so tunnel vision into mm-hmm. it. And that's what the surgeon looked at me. He's like, you're like a duck to water. Like, you are good at this. You seem mm-hmm. like you're enjoying this. And I was like, I really do. And I kind of just, you can't explain it to people. You can say, oh, you'll know when you know. But mm-hmm. really and truthfully, when you find that niche, you know, you feel it.
I think it's something that when something speaks to your soul.
Right.
That's for me. And that's what passion is. And
correct.
Some of us, I think, find passion young, and some of us need life experiences and also need to kind of learn who the heck we are as an individual before we can find that, or at least maybe hear it. Because isn't correct. That the hard part? Just like you said, saying yes and trying new things is super scary, and it takes some courage.
Definitely takes courage.
Yeah, but it was totally worth it, right?
Totally worth it. I mean, I was 22 years old. And that's kind of how it started. And from there, it just progressed. And I was very fortunate enough, and I didn't realize it at the time, because mm-hmm. this was my first experience with surgeons in the medical field, how much of a teacher he was and how mm-hmm. much that benefited me, because he was willing to teach every step of the way. And his motto was kind of, there's no stupid question. You know, you're never going to know if you don't ask. So ask me whatever you want. And he always had tons of reps and people in the room and teaching people and trying out new things in ophthalmic surgery. So I got so much exposure that I didn't really realize until later on how much of an asset that was to me, especially to where I am now.
And I love that, especially as you have talked about how busy the practice was and 40 to 50 procedures a day. And yet this person still took the time to be a mentor and an educator. And to me, that should be admired.
Absolutely.
How lucky you are to have had that experience.
Right. And he would take us to lectures. He would let us come to any talks, any meetings. So that it was just great. It was great exposure. And I wish more surgeons took the opportunity to ask their people that work with them, even their scrub techs at hospital, like, hey, if you would like to learn more, you know, you're more than welcome to come to my clinic if you have an off day, and just kind of see why this matters in here mm-hmm. and for what the outcome will be in the clinic.
Right.
Because I think that's what encourages the passion as well. So I think if I didn't have the clinical side along with the surgery, it wouldn't have intrigued me as much as it did, but we're talking about people's vision, right? You have five senses. Huge. And yeah. Your sight is a major one. Without your sight, it's debilitating to people that go blind or things mm-hmm. that happen. So it's very critical. I always want to do the best I can at whatever it is I'm doing. And to be able to help somebody see or get their vision back is just amazing. You know, it's God's gifts, you know, that they give these surgeons anyway, the ability to do this. And then their moral and ethical beliefs and doing right and wrong by them for such a major surgery with for their eyes is, I just think it's incredible. I have a lot of respect.
I think that's great. So what did school look like for you? Did you attend school and how did that go?
So I started working at Eyesight Associates in 2007. I decided I really loved surgery and I wanted to see kind of what else I could do, how much further I could push myself. So I was like, you know, I want to go to surgical school. I want to see what else I can do, get more exposure. So I went 2010, I moved to Atlanta and I wanted to do trauma. I'm kind of a go big or go home kind of person. So Grady is a trauma one.
I relate so much.
I know. Yeah. Like, I don't know what it is, adrenaline junkie or what, but so I decided there was only one school that allowed students to go to Grady for surgical tech extern, and that was Everest Institute, and it was in Marietta. That's where I enrolled at Everest. Unfortunately, the school doesn't even exist anymore. Oh, so I went from 2010, 2012 and started my surgical rotation and I loved it. And it was so funny because I guess because eyes is such a delicate, tedious, detailed type of surgery, I liked those type of fields better. I loved vascular. I liked neuro. Everybody else was like, I'll just do general. And I'm looking at the board like, oh, I want to go in there. I want to go do that hard case.
Yeah. Plastics. So, was that something that also interested you? Cause that's a very like detail oriented field.
At Grady, there wasn't a ton of plastics there because Grady as well is a teaching hospital. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those hospitals that had students, you know, Emory residents. I mean, you'd have a room sometimes with 15 people in there with you. I didn't do a lot of plastics. It's funny. I didn't do any labor and delivery. I didn't do any plastics because I was always signing up for the ones that nobody else wanted to do. So I didn't get a lot of that basic stuff. But I mean, of course, I did all of my services, generals. And,
so were you still working at Eyesight Associates or is that, I guess, geographically?
Geographically, Warner Robins is about an hour and a half south of Grady in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Grady's right downtown. So I didn't. I actually was waitressing because my schooling was full-time. Then I waitressed at Red Lobster and then a place called Brew House, Pub House, and Little Five Points in Atlanta. So it was just kind of a grind.
Sure.
I did come back in 2012. I had my own kind of medical emergency, a ruptured ectopic that I experienced. Oh, and I did move back in 2012 to Warner Robins and I did go back to Eyesight. It's definitely been an off and on relationship with Eyesight, but it's just such a great place and they really care about their patients and they do what's right. And it's where I originated.
They teach their stuff, which I
think they teach. And then I found SightPath, which is a roll-on, roll-off ophthalmic company, mm-hmm. which traveled, that specialized in only ophthalmic surgery. So I did that off and on for years. And I kind of, now I'm at different PRM places, different places where I can to help with eye surgeons. Because I just want to help whoever I can. And at this point, I've built so many good relationships with eye surgeons and I just want to give them what they need, right? That's our job. Provide for them, make sure they're good. And if you care about what you do, you always want to do that for the ones you develop good relationships with.
I think there's, as an educator, because a lot of eye surgeries are not done in our main facilities, that we don't always get to provide that rotation for our students. And in Knoxville, I'm working really hard to kind of develop those relationships and get that to be a specialty rotation for our students, because we have a national shortage of CSTs everywhere.
Correct.
And eye surgery is not any different. You know, they're constantly looking for staff too.
Right.
And that might not be an area that students realize is a job opportunity.
Correct.
Which is kind of cool about what we do in the operating room, and our job as CSCs anyway, is because you can do those PRN services and jobs. So what does a day in the life look like for you when you're working?
It is, well, it depends where I'm at, but for the most part, it is just paying attention. And I think that's the biggest thing about eyes is, it's a big thing for me. And I actually, everywhere I've gone, I've encouraged the knowledge training that we need. And I try to provide it to the circulating nurses and the other techs that don't have any clinical experience or any eye experience. And I try to teach them whatever they would like to know. I would love to tell them, because I can look at certain calculations and stuff when it comes to an implant that we're going to implant through a surgery. And I can look at axial links, or I can look at their K's or their astigmatism, and I can automatically tell certain things about that patient and then be able to ask them questions to make sure we're doing what we need to do. So that is so important to me, that people understand the value of what it means, what you're looking at, mm-hmm. what astigmatism is, what a cataract is, if they come back, if they don't come back, how difficult it is. And the thing with eye surgeries as well, they're just under, you know, topical. So they're just getting Versed and IV. They're awake.
Yeah.
And being able to comfort that patient, and the more knowledge you have as a tech, especially in eyes, the better your patient is, and the better they're going to behave during surgery, because every tech knows under a microscope, a little movement is a massive movement.
So,
and it's such a delicate surgery anyway in the eye. It's definitely something that knowledge will help all the way around if they can get it. And here's the thing I tell people, ask, what's the surgeon going to say? I don't want to talk about it, or I don't want to talk about it.
Especially
now.
If your patient's asleep or awake.
So, and when something, the thing with eyes is that it's so funny to me that people are so scared of eyes, because it's very routine, because the majority of it's cataract surgery. Cataract surgeries are very routine, typically. Same steps, they may alter based on what the surgeon needs. But the thing is, when things go wrong, it's just being prepared to have those few things that if a surgeon asks, or if he doesn't ask, because he may get really stressed out. He may be a surgeon that gets stressed out and gets quiet, and you just need to have a couple things you need to know. And those things aren't hard to learn. If you can do these neuro cases and these ortho cases and all this, like, come on. But I tell people, I think it's the suture, right? That trips everybody out. It's like a strand of hair.
It is.
Where is it?
So I have a story to relay. I was a trauma scrub at a level one trauma center. I did liver transplants, like big bellies, you know, all the adrenaline filled things. But one of our ophthalmologic techs retired, and I was low man on the totem pole. And so they're basically what we call voluntold. Chris, you're doing
that's
eyes.
Great. Voluntold, I love it.
Exactly. And I didn't have an eye rotation when I was in school. And I mean, hello, from like neck down is my jam. That's what I did every day. And so when they told me, you're going to do eyes, of course I said yes, because I don't know the word no either.
Correct.
I was a fish out of water. For sure. Mm-hmm. And it's this cold room. It's super dark. Your patient is awake, so you're very quiet, and you're loading lenses in the dark. You're loading this suture that is 10-0, 11-0 in the dark on non-locking needle drivers, because God forbid we bend the needle.
Right.
And it was just a completely different experience, even passing, because you don't want to hit the microscope.
Right. You have such a small space to pass.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, the BSS, and they would say, wet me. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What do you want me to do? You want me to go underneath the microscope? I mean, I think it was probably comedic relief in the eye room, because I was so used to being in a completely different situation. But I learned so much. And I think my hesitancy, just personally, and maybe other people will relate, is that when we drape out our patient when we're doing abdominal surgery, even chest and mm-hmm. all the other areas, once you've put those drapes on, it's almost like seeing the parts of a car versus the entire car. So it helps you narrow your focus and more concentrate on the procedure as opposed to the human side.
You can detach just a little bit. Yeah,
exactly. Which I think sometimes, especially in trauma surgery, you need to detach a little bit so that you stay on task. But when you're draping an eye and when you're doing those surgeries, there's no escaping the fact that that's a human being laying down. And I think that that can be intimidating.
Yeah. And that they're awake, and most people are freaked out about their eyes. Like, you're going to get people laying there and you tell them what you're going to do. I try to explain very detailed. You're going to feel me touch you. When I put this drape on, it's not going to stay on. You have oxygen. People are claustrophobic. People are going to blink like crazy. So again, finding a way. I ask people about your kids. What did you do for a job? Do you have grandchildren? You know, you just try to distract them with something that can kind of calm them, because they're all, I want medicine. And then you have what we call second eye syndrome. So when they come back for their second eye, they don't remember anything from the first eye, from the Versed, right? Gives them the type of amnesia.
Oh, the good old drug.
Yes. So they can't remember. So then they're even more freaked out the second time because they can't remember the first time. They're like, this is not what you did last time. I'm like, yeah, if I had a nickel for every time somebody told me that, I'd be rich. I was like, I promise you it's going to be the same. I promise when we get done, I'll tell you the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just a comfort thing. What's funny, and I should have mentioned this a few minutes ago, is when I was in school, because I already had eye training, they mm-hmm. did the same thing to us at Grady. They said, no students allowed in the eye room. You can go work with Dr. Sanjay Gupta in the neuro room and do disectomies and do this, but you can't go in the eye room. And I had a fit because I knew I had enough experience and I was good that I wanted to go in there. I had that confidence in myself. So I told them, I was like, listen, I want to go in the eye room. They're like, well, you can't. I said, well, I want to. And they're like, well, if you want to, you're going to have to ask the surgeon and go. So do you know they ended up putting me in front of a board and grilled me for like 2 hours on my eye knowledge to go in there?
That's crazy.
I was like, fine, I'll do it. I'll answer all your questions. I'll talk about glaucoma, the trabecular meshwork, the cornea, the different viscoelastics, the different three-piece versus one-piece implants. Mm. What I need to hand you. And they grilled me, but I passed and they finally let me in. I was the only student that was allowed
Good
to go in
you.
There. But it just persistence and not being scared and wanting to know, people, at least if they don't have anything else, they're going to respect you.
Yeah. And that's huge, I think, in the operating room, because I don't think that CSTs in general always get that respect. And I think the reason that you did is, number one, you had courage. And number two, you knew the why. And that in any surgery, understanding the why we do what we do or why we pass certain suture or certain equipment and supplies, that goes a long way in giving you that respect that you absolutely deserved.
Well, and we, as a scrub tech too, I've kind of learned over the years that you almost have to demand your respect sometimes for your position in the room, because especially now, the time of traveling nurses and techs, and you have to be able to say, hey, listen, my name's on this chart. I'm also responsible. I'm a surgical assistant in this case, and what I say matters. And the surgeons, you know, especially if they already know you, they know your capability and they want you in there for the most part. But you have to be able to stand up and say, hey, this is not right. Time out. We need to stop. I need to double check this. Let me see that again. This is not, you know, so I think if you, as a scrub tech, all scrub techs, no matter what service they're in, I wish they learned that self-confidence to just stand up and say, if you hear any kind of inner voice telling you anything, right? I mean, we learned the when in doubt, throw it out, you know, we learned those little things, but that rule should apply to everything, to be able to speak your opinion and your voice because it's only going to make you better and it's only going to earn your respect. And even if it's something you question that's not wrong, the fact that you're able to question it says a lot about your character.
Right.
And we have to have more patient advocates in the medical field now more than ever.
It's so important. I think as an educator, I can tell you, like, from day one, we talk about surgical conscience and just pound that into our students and finding your OR voice.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody's extroverted. You know, not all of us are, I guess, wired to be able to speak up, but there isn't another area where it's more important to do so than in the operating room, because that patient cannot, even if they are awake, you mentioned they have Versed, they've got propofol on board. They cannot advocate for themselves. Yeah. That's our job, regardless of the specialty. So I'm so proud of you for saying that.
It's definitely important. And I mean, if you're in this role as a scrub tech and you've lost that ability or the want to advocate for what's happening in the room and for the patient, you might want to look at yourself and say, maybe this is not where I need to be anymore.
Yeah.
Because that's why we do it. That's why a majority of us have gotten in the health field. And then the surgical people like us, the scrub techs, we want to be hands-on because we want to be helping make the change and helping with the solution. I really wish that somebody had come to the high schools, and I've thought about this lately, about going to the high schools and trying to talk to them, because people should know what's in this field or that this position exists. I mean, I've gone and we're nurses that don't work in the OR area. They don't even know what a scrub tech is. I'm like, how are you a nurse and you don't know what a scrub tech is?
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. And I really wish that we got more of the recognition.
I completely agree. I'm speaking in Pakistan next week.
Oh my gosh, how exciting.
I know. It's their first ever international allied health symposium. And I get to be the American speaker. So, like, no pressure.
Wow.
But
you know what? But God's given you that opportunity, right? And this is your purpose. And you found your calling and having a voice. Yeah. And helping people and bringing awareness. So that's absolutely amazing that you just keep pushing through.
I can't say
speaking in all these places. I watch you and I think it's amazing.
Oh, man.
Well, I want to be like you one day.
Oh, please don't ask for that. I wouldn't want anybody. Stephanie Austin is laughing out loud right now.
Oh my
goodness. I can hear her in my head because she's like, you are a hot mess. Like, there's no way around it.
But you gotta be a hot mess, right? All the people in the world that are a hot mess, they're the people that have the courage, right? To try it, you know?
Or the stupidity, yeah. But the only reason that I bring it up is because that's the speech, is how we allied health team members are integral to the care of a patient. And we have to know each other because... And let's say we've talked about neuro, like, I can't do my job if I don't know in the rad tech, and the rad tech doesn't take excellent images, and our patients cannot be anesthetized and the blocks aren't going to happen if you don't have your anesthesia tech that's assisting your anesthesia provider and the respiratory care, you know, again, just there are so many of us. And then of course the sterile processors who are in the operating room, but if they don't do their job well,
we can't do ours.
Exactly. All the aseptic technique in the world is for naught. But we all have to understand who the other player in the room is and give them that respect. And that comes from working as a team. And I think we need to be better at that as a profession and take the lead on doing so. And you, I think, are a great example of the importance of that, because especially in eyes, like, let's talk about the timeout. Right site surgery for you all is critical because you're not always operating on both eyes. So making sure the consent and that you are operating on OD for right or OS for left, and understanding that lies on you. Have you ever had an experience where the consent versus what you went to do is
all the time.
Luckily,
because I have clinical experience, I sometimes step out of the box and I try to develop good relationships with the pre-op and the charge nurse or the directors and just tell them, hey, if you have a question, let me know. You know, if the surgeon's not there yet and we already got four patients in pre-op dilating, but the consent says one thing and the patient's saying another, or the patient said, oh, well, I did eye drops in my left eye, but supposedly we're doing the right eye. So there's a lot of things that come into play. We can say, okay, well, if they need both eyes done, and now they've done their pre-op drops and we've dilated one eye, but the consent is the other, we can ask the surgeon, hey, can we proceed with the eye that actually has been prepped for surgery as far as pre-antibiotics and stuff like that and dilating? Or they say, no, for whatever reason, pull the chart, let's look at the details and then go from there. And yeah, we do one eye at a time because eyes can heal differently. So it's one, insurance reasons we do one at a time, and then two, just to make sure we get a good result from the first eye and don't need to make adjustments for implantation reasons before we do the second. Because we can set somebody for distance vision, but they may heal intermediate, which is like your dashboard, your computer, things like that. And so if that's the case, we may have to, the surgeon may want to fudge the calculation to make sure, okay, let's make sure we definitely get them more distance because they drive still. So we need to make sure we get them that, because most people don't realize once you have cataract surgery and you take the lens, their natural lens out, the cataract, you don't get to keep what you had before.
No, totally different measurements.
Totally different. And so there's a lot of little things that play into it. But to me, it's so interesting, but I guess that's why it's my passion. So yeah, it's just asking the questions and being prepared. But there's definitely scenarios where, and that's where you have to say, okay, stop. And even on a calculation sheet, a nurse, it's so weird. And I don't know why they've done this in eyes, but on the calculation sheet, the right eye, which is OD, will be on the left side of the page. And the left eye, OS, is on the right side of the page.
Oh my gosh, it's like a mirror image.
Right. So I tell people, you know, if you don't know your abbreviation, OD and OS, like that's rule number one. You need to know what we're doing. And in eyes, a lot of places I go, we do timeout cards where it literally goes in a sleeve and it hangs on the bed. Because there's so many times during a surgery where we need to ask their name or to look at the light or, you know, do this or do that or try not to blink or open both eyes so you don't have as much pressure on your speculum.
Yeah.
So you're not squeezing so hard so you don't get posterior pressure underneath the eye. So there's all those little things that if you can keep and then so I can look at my timeout card and go, okay, yeah, I do have the right implant. This is what we're doing. It's just always good to double check everything, triple check.
I love it. Here's the thing I do as an educator, and I want to get your take on it too, because I have to, even if my students don't get a specialty in ophthalmology, obviously they still need to understand for their CST exam. So I do my lecture. And when it comes to OD and OS and OU and all these abbreviations, I say, okay, does anybody watch Dexter? Right? The Showtime show. Cause Dexter was a serial killer who killed, but he only killed people that were bad. Like he only killed the bad guys. So rapists and other murderers. The whole thing. Well, that's what I tell them. Like, does anybody watch Dexter? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, Dexter was right in killing because he only killed bad guys. And so OD is Oculus Dexter and Dexter is right. And they're like, Chris, you're crazy. I'm like, I know, but like, go for it. And then I say, so sinister, the word sinister means bad. So if Dexter was right, then sinister is the opposite of that. And that's what makes him left. And then by process of elimination, you know, that OU is for both. And they're like, okay, but it sticks. So how did you figure out what was your kind of crazy method for remembering the differences?
So I think because I was in clinic as a scribe, when I was learning, it was something you just didn't have a choice. Like you just had to learn it. But another little tip though, I give people who are really struggling with that. If you hold up your right hand, like almost like the sign language, like, okay, if you hold up your right hand, it's going to make a D. If you hold up your left hand, it's going to make a B. Awesome. So if you're ever curious, just make like a, you know, put your pointer finger to your thumb and your other one's up and whichever hand makes a D, that's your right.
That's it. Oh, so good. I love little tricks of the trade like that.
Well, and I always tell people to like the foot pedals, right? In cataract surgery, you have your phaco foot pedal and the microscope. And the only way I could ever remember when I first started learning, someone once told me, phaco is the right thing to do. So phaco pedal always on the right for literally 98% of surgeons. Even if they're left-handed, phaco is the right thing to do. So phaco's on the right.
Oh, I love those. Little tricks like that save us. And I think that also speaks to, I think our patients aren't going to know OD versus OS. And so when they are listening to their team in pre-op talk about what, you know, which eye and right side surgery, they're still not going to understand and be able to advocate for themselves because they don't know that OD is right or OS is left. They just correct. Know that they're in there and they're supposed to follow directions. And so I think it speaks even more to the fact that you have to advocate for your patient and do all those double and triple checks.
Yeah. And I typically, most of our circulators will say phaco right eye, phaco left eye, only because one, the patient is awake so they can hear and because they're not going to know. And it just gives more clarity because the majority of the people in your room don't know it.
It's true.
So you just might as well say right eye. Like it's not, no one's going to judge you because you're not saying phaco with intraocular lens implant OG. I'm like, what?
So one of the things that I learned and I loved about eye surgery, because there are extraocular procedures that we do. Then there are intraocular to the anterior chamber. Mm-hmm. And then of course we have our posterior chamber surgeries. But when you do a phaco emulsification, which for those listening who might not understand, that's the name of the surgery where we are taking a cataract out. That cataract is a crystallized lens that no longer allows, you know, light and refraction to occur. So we have to, it's like a meat grinder. It goes in and it breaks it up into quadrants and grinds at the crystallized lens and sucks it out, but you have to replace that. And correct. So that lens that's replaced is similar to a contact and it goes, for those laymen who are not as good, what I loved about that, and please, you can correct me on the lens thing in a minute, but when someone's had a phaco, you can tell when you look them in the eye because they have this like chromatic, I almost say like when sunlight hits oil on a road.
A twinkle in their eye. Like
exactly. I think that's so cool. So correct me. I always used to compare it as an educator to like a contact that we've put inside the anterior chamber. Explain that better for me, please.
So when I explain cataracts, I tell people, think about a chocolate M&M. And if you took a small circular punch out of the top, like the size of an eraser, and you put it in the top, that's our capsulotomy we do, right? We take that little center circular hole with a capsulorexis, forceps, create the opening. And when you go in with your phaco handpiece, it uses ultrasonic energy. So the energy is what's breaking up your cataract into smaller pieces. And you still have your shell of an M&M. So what you're doing with the phaco handpiece is you're taking all the chocolate, which is the pacified cataract or the lens, and you're taking it out. So where you still have a shell, you're leaving and all the chocolate's gone. All the mess is gone.
All the good stuff.
Yep. All the good stuff is gone. Oh, not so good anymore. Yeah. Because cataracts grow like rings on a tree. They get bigger and bigger and bigger the longer they're in. And the bigger they're in. And so the longer cataracts in, the more dangerous and more dense the cataract procedure becomes. So when it comes out, the lens implant, I mean, typically your incisions or people go anywhere from 2.0 to 3.0 is typical, but 2.4, 2.5 millimeter incision with a keratome is where you're putting your lens cartridge in. And most lenses are acrylic, about a 6 millimeter lens that's folded with little arms, little haptics, and like a taco. So when they go in, and then what it does is it sits in that bag and opens up in that space where that chocolate was, and which is underneath the iris. So it's inside the bag. It's in the posterior portion of the eye. So, and that capsule is held by little zonules, little strings that suspend underneath the iris that hold that capsule in place. A cataract never grows back. Some people, you know, may get secondary cataracts. that it's a film that forms because that implant material, whether it's a hydrophobic acrylic or hydrophilic or a silicone lens, it's a foreign material. So you can get a film that develops on the backside of that capsule, and people think their cataracts are coming back, but it's not. It can be done in the office with a little YAG laser. It takes 10 seconds.
Really? And it can just be treated.
Right. It's like if you thought about holding a piece of wax paper up and then you just punched a couple holes in the middle of it and it kind of falls back open to allow that vision to come back.
Man, so tell me, what are some other misnomers that people that don't specialize in your field, what are some other things that maybe your patients think are happening that's not? Shed some light on that.
That they think are happening that are not. There's really no needle and rarely ever suturing that you hardly have to do in cataract surgery anymore because the millimeter is so small. We don't do a lot of, and I mean, unless you're doing a extracapsular cataract extraction where it's so dense, it's coming out whole.
And that means that you're taking the shell of the M&M too. Is that what you mean by extracapsular?
Yeah, like, because it's chocolate. So dense and so grown together that it cannot be broken up by the phaco handpiece.
Really? Man, yeah. how often do you think that happens?
It just depends on your demographic and your area. I mean, if you're in a third world country, you're going to see it a lot because it's, you know, or just exposure. You're going to see it and it's cool. I mean, they're like little marbles. I mean, they're hard as a rock. You have your different layers of your cornea, your endothelium, which is the bottom layer of your cornea, most superior part of your anterior chamber. As much energy is going into the eye, you don't want to damage those endothelial cells because that can create haze in the cornea.
Mm.
So people that work in cataracts, there's going to be a phaco time or a CDE number on their phaco machine. And that's actually the computed amount of dispersed energy that's put into the eye during surgery.
And that time is there a safe window or a spectrum of time that you guys aim for when you're
doing it? So it's not a calculated like second by second time. It's a computed formulated time based on the energy and the irrigation aspiration that's used during the case. But I like to tell people when I start, when I'm draping them, okay, you're going to feel a lot of irrigation on your eye. It's going to feel like a bath or just, you know, a bunch of water. That's okay. It's just keeping you from drying out. We're going to put numbing drops in probably. They're going to sting and burn for a minute. Then it's going to go away and you're going to feel touch and his hands around you. And I think letting them know kind of what to expect because they are going to be awake makes a huge difference. For them, just telling them those things.
So why are patients awake during ophthalmic surgery?
It's actually critical. I mean, if you think about it, right? When people go to sleep, their eyes roll up in their head or you can't control. And you also, a lot of surgeons want to verify at the end, hey, how many lights do you see? Or can you see the light? Or because if something happens and they can't see light anymore, there's a problem. I mean, typically they're going to know there's a problem if that were to occur,
right.
But it's really a minimally invasive when you're talking about cataract surgery. I mean, but we do a lot of minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries now. Eye stent, eye access, some people still do trabeculotomies, you know, all kind of things, but it's just really important that they understand how important it is for them to follow direction. Because the surgeon needs it. Otherwise, you got to put a Traxxin suture in. I mean, and sometimes we have to block patients because they're just not going to stay still. But it's actually is more rare now that we have to do that. But there's still some people that surgeons that want everybody blocked because they don't want to risk them moving.
Well, especially when you're talking about a 1 or 2 millimeter incision, and just for, I don't know, what do you, when you educate patients on how small that is, what do you compare a 2 millimeter incision to that allows them to understand how tiny that is?
You know, what's funny is they typically don't ask about their incisions. Do you know what they ask me more about? They ask
me if they
wash their hair and their face.
Oh, okay. I can kind of get that, especially as a woman. Like you feel dirty at the end of the day if you don't wash your
face. Or like, why do I have to sleep with this eye shield on at nighttime? you know, and then, you know, I tell them, well, you know, a lot of times you rub your eyes when you sleep and you do have a very small micro incision. It needs a good, you know, 4 or 5 days to kind of start closing up to heal, to make sure, you know, nothing's getting in it, and even any soap or anything like that. And that's another thing I wanted to mention when you were talking about the sterile processing people in eyes. So that's another big difference in eyes. It's kind of always been the rule, we don't typically use enzymatic detergents through eye instruments, or use a pH neutral detergent, or just a clean rinse to follow the DFUs. And a lot of sterile processing places that do eyes, people forget to go in there and talk to the sterile processing people about it, because they just assume they know. Right. And so I always, even though it's not really in my scope of practice or my job or my responsibility, at the end of the day, it is my responsibility, because I'm going to get those instruments back and I need to make sure that they were rinsed properly. And because everything's so delicate and so cannulated, you just want to make sure. And what does it hurt you to go say, hey, do you have any questions about how to sterilize these? Because if you do, I can answer them for you, or I can get somebody to answer them for you, because I want you to. Nobody wants to do something that then they learn later was wrong. And then now your conscience is like, oh my gosh, what if something happens, right? Because most of the time you don't see your patients after they leave the OR. Also, nobody wants to go to bed with that thought.
No. And, you know, on our titanium instruments and our microvascular instruments, and especially I would think on ophthalmologic instruments, everything is so tiny. So any cavitation in the metal, or any maybe chip of a toothed instrument, you wouldn't even be able to see unless it's under the microscope. And by then your patient's on the table and it's in the surgeon's hands, and it might be too late at that moment.
And that's another thing, I'm glad you brought that up. So I think another reason eye surgery is for techs, right? Everything's so tiny, the instruments, the little, if it's a Lester, it's a little tiny notch on the end of a skinny little instrument that's so frail. And I tell some people, as we get older, I'm actually experiencing this myself, a little presbyopia, where your near starts kind of leaving you a little bit. Yes. And because you are like cat woman or cat man working in the dark, you can feel, but you still want to be able to tell. But I tell people, even if they wear glasses or contacts or not, when you're in surgery, pop a near contact in one of your eyes, ask your surgeon or ask your optometrist, whoever your eye doctor is, if you wear glasses or contacts anyway, and wear a near contact or closer up so that you can see. Just for while you're in surgery.
Wow. I hadn't even thought about that, because it is so hard. And I remember, I mean, I was in my 20s back then when I was doing that, and it was still hard. I can't imagine it almost 46. Trying to find the tips of those instruments and load the suture.
And loading the implants, you know, and like I said, putting that near contact in, just try it. If you don't like it, take it out. But I'm telling you, I've offered that to so many people and they've tried it and they're like,
life changing.
Oh my gosh, so much, because then they have their confidence back because they can see and they don't feel like an idiot when the surgeon says, why'd you hand me this? This is not what I asked for. And you're like,
I can't see the damn thing. That's
right. And even the light, like the glare, a lot of time in surgeries, even if you have your full room lights on, or if you're using your overhead lights right on the middle of your table, for eyes, I always kind of put it off to the side because it kind of creates too much glare and glisten. Right. Just little micro things like that, little pearls that it can help you. But if you don't know to ask or know to do, then you don't know what to do at all. You just kind of like,
That's a whole other podcast. It's like, what do I do when I have no clue it's coming? Because
But I promise, like, I'm the type, if anybody sees this or whoever's listening, if they have questions and want to ask me, reach out, I will be more than happy, because we're only as strong as the people we pass on our knowledge to.
I completely agree. So you're good with me putting out, I'll put some contact information.
Absolutely. I would love to help anybody that has questions.
That would be great. So we talked a lot about phacos, and which is, you know, our cataract surgeries. Other than that, like, do you do retinal surgeries as well? Do you have experience in that? Or what is like your favorite surgery, the craziest thing you've ever done?
I personally have, that's probably the only area I haven't done is retina. I've done corneal transplants, tons of glaucoma, pterygium surgeries, blepharoplasties, ptosis, entropians, you know, osteoclasts. My favorite. That's interesting.
That's a loaded question.
I don't know if I per se have a favorite, because even after doing it 15 years, and when you work with multiple different surgeons, you're always learning different things. The same procedure surgeons will do different ways. But I just think my favorite thing is just honestly probably asking and then learning on the surgeon's perspective on why they do what they do, and then offering my feedback, whether they like it or not sometimes, just because it engages the conversation.
Sure. Well, so it's also good for them to be challenged every now and then.
I mean, I have a surgeon when I first started working there, I was just their PRN, and he used to tell the girls, okay, I need y'all to tell me when Katie's coming. And they're like, why? And he's like, I need to be prepared for Katie, because she's going to ask me a lot of stuff, and she's going to hold me and, you know, grill me. And I thought it was funny. And now I think now that he knows that I'm not questioning him as a surgeon, I'm actually just so intrigued and curious about the procedures and his perspective, that he knows it's not an insult or a shot. It's me trying to be there for him.
Yeah, curiosity.
So that's our job, is to anticipate. And everybody may want something a little different or think a little different about something. So,
yeah. Well, and I would think that in that realm, especially in eye surgical centers, your turnover and the speed and efficiency of the surgery, in order to be that efficient, you have to know how to anticipate what your surgeon's going to need, because otherwise they're the, you know, seconds equal minutes, which equal hours, and that can really slow down the entire day.
Well, and that's the thing, I've honestly been asking my surgeons probably the last year, what could help you if you get a tech that doesn't know, or what is your biggest thing about an eye scrub tech that would make you feel better? And they all kind of say consistency. I just want consistency into, or wanting to learn, or, you know, asking. And so I think that's just part of it. They know, because they know that there's not a, they don't teach eyes in school.
Right.
And the sad thing for them is they have the same struggle in their clinics, because they don't teach eye techs, COAs. So in ophthalmology itself, because it is so specialized, they're pretty much having to train people on the job, or they get people that have been trained somewhere else, which is unfortunate that they experience that so much. But I guess it's like that in a lot of subspecialties, that they don't offer these programs for people because I guess they don't recognize the need. And so, but if they don't even recognize surgical techs as a whole, I mean, why would they recognize this small specialties? So that's the fight. And I hope at some point we can change that.
Well, I do too. And I think conversations like this, I think that they help that plight, and also having people who are passionate about understanding the why and everything that you're doing, you know, and your openness to pass on what you've learned in your journey through this. I don't see how that couldn't be anything other than positive.
So, yeah, we got to get the surgeons to start saying it though, too. You got to get them to say, hey, you want us in your room, because they'll be the first ones. I want to work with this person. I want this tech.
Yeah. And we need to know why. It's not because like they're my best friend. It's because they're going to make that surgery go smoothly, which also ultimately, and the whole point of all of this is that that patient gets excellent care. And the only way we do that is if everybody's on their A game.
Right. And the energy, the relationship between a surgeon and a tech, it's special. I mean, it's to be able to have a non-communicative relationship while you're working.
Yeah,
you know, is just like, oh yeah, we're going to do this. We're doing it good. You know, we're on it. And that is a great feeling. Nobody wants to be working with somebody, whether you're a waitress, whether you're a male, you know, in any job profession, nobody wants to work with somebody that is not on the same semi-level as them in some sort of way.
And also cares. Like, I think just caring about whether or not you're doing your job well, or that patient's getting great care, that level of passion will make up for any skill set that may be lacking due to, you know, lack of experience.
So absolutely.
I think that's great. So, okay, tell me, like, craziest eye surgery ever, like craziest situation you've ever been, like, We all have that one story. They're like, you're never gonna believe this.
But I remember the first time we were doing a cataract case, and it was what's called a polar cat, and the lens can fall through the bag, and then you get into vitreous. So vitreous is what helps shape the eye.
Yeah, that's and the humor, or that like gelatin fluid.
It's the clear jelly-like little syringe that you'll hand them at different points in the case, right before you take the cataract out, to fill the space, to take the cataract out, and then at the end to refill and open up the bag so that you can put your implant in. We just got into a complicated case and got into some complications with it, and the eye literally started deflating like a water balloon that sprung a leak, and it was just, you know, concave in. And I was like, oh my God.
No, because the shape of the eye, I mean, we talk about form equals function in everything, but like for real, the shape of the eye is.
And the thing with eyes is, when things go bad, I mean, even if you have to get into a vitrectomy or whatever, like everything is going to go super fast, super stressed, and you cannot fumble. And you just have to be ready for the surgeon, because the surgeon's trying to figure out what they're doing too and what's happening. Yeah, that was probably the scariest and the freakiest thing, seeing the eye completely deflate like this, because I thought to myself, how the hell do we fix this? Like, how do we come out of this okay?
Like, how do you plug the leak? I mean, what did y'all end up doing to save
just
it?
Tons and tons of viscoelastic. Tons and tons of viscoelastic. Try to pressurize. I can't remember if we ended up putting an air bubble at the end, or suturing and closing, and then sometimes having to put a bandage contact lens on the top. I don't remember exactly what we did at the end. It ended up being okay, but anytime you get into the retina, they're probably going to have some vision loss. And I don't know if it was a bad eye anyway, because some people have blind eyes, and a lot of surgeons will say, oh, well, you're never going to see good out of it, so we're not going to try. And then you have some surgeons who say, well, there is a possibility that you may get some sight out of it, so that it doesn't become a painful eye, or, you know, down the road, or just because it's going to keep getting worse. So we're going to try it, but there's no promises. And it's up to the patient to make that. But yeah, that was super scary.
So scary.
I do remember a funny story. You were talking about doing transplants and stuff, and the donor stuff. Before I started at my job, the girls had told me the story. They used to take all their supplies and implants and everything they needed, and they would take it to a hospital about 45 minutes away. Early in the morning, they all meet at the office, you know, drive. Well, they were all loading their stuff, you know, checking all their bags, their charts, and they left the transplant in the cooler on the roof. And they didn't realize it till they're driving down the road and they see the styrofoam cooler. And I remember them telling me that, and I thought, because I was doing this route now where I was doing, I was like, oh my God, I am so terrified that that's going to happen to me. That now, like, I'm like, first thing, put it in the back seat.
Give me the corner.
Don't worry about yourself.
Oh my God.
Put it in there.
Yeah.
Or little things. I remember my first glaucoma surgery, Trebek. He would cut a little square flap, and you had these little Calibri forceps, and you'd have to hold it and then still, you know, be able to pass instruments, because you'd have to put a shunt in. And I remember I literally have been working there like a week, and looks at me and he's like, hold this flap. And I was like, what? And he's like, hold it. He's like, whatever you do, don't rip it off, because the girl just did that not long ago. I was like, okay.
No pressure.
I mean, like, any tiny, it's like, and then you have movements that you don't even know that you're moving, and you don't want to like put your hand on top of the patient's nose and mouth, you know, because they're awake and trying to breathe.
Oh my God.
So I think in eyes, you learn how to like internal your fear.
Oh yeah. Your freak out moment has to be in your gut and not on your face, for sure.
Well, it'll be on my face. It just can't come out my mouth. So, and that's a hard thing for me. I'm a no filter kind of person. I was most nervous about this interview. I'm like, oh my gosh, hopefully I don't say nothing crazy.
Oh, please. Are you kidding? Yeah. Oh, listen to the former episodes. I do it all the time. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
And somebody keeps letting us do these for some reason.
Hey, so we're in there. They obviously like it. I guess there's more people out there like us than we think.
Right? Which, thank God for that.
Thank God.
That's what makes the world fun.
Yes. Well,
so another personal story, just because I want to talk about the future of eye surgery and what you think is out there that's coming. But I was, my mom and I were hit by a drunk driver when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And so my dad had a phaco like the day before, not even 24 hours post-op. And so my mom, I have to give mouth to mouth to my, we're both taken to trauma centers. It was life-changing, stopped my volleyball career because I played volleyball in college. And anyway, like that's all another episode, right? Or maybe not, but life-changing. After a phaco, which is a really routine, I mean, I hate saying it, that's almost one of those like, don't.
No, it is though. It's a routine, but at this point,
but you're not supposed to have any, you know, so we don't want any hypertensive issues because that can cause, you know, pressure in the heart, pressure systemically causes pressure increase in the eye, which is well, there's nothing like a good old pressure inducing situation than to have your wife and your daughter in a trauma center and not doing
right that. Right.
So my dad had a retinal tear due to that, and nine surgeries. So he had oil, he had like the gap, the bubble, right? Prone. I mean, all of these different procedures had to happen. And that was before I was ever in the OR. So I didn't even have the medical background to understand what all he was going through, which gives me sympathy for patient education, because I'm sure as well as they explained it, it still just was a little mind-blowing for what was going on and what we needed to do after the surgery and how important that was. But then you skip a few years later and now I'm in the operating room and I have exposure to eyes and I'm watching us do these procedures that are, they've grown so much from when my dad had to go through them. We take an entirely different approach to retinal tears than what they did back then. And maybe outcomes would have been different. So I say all of that because the changes in surgery, regardless of what specialty, they happen in real time. And 10 years ago, if somebody had said, hey, by the way, we're going to use robots routinely to operate on people, nobody would have, they thought it was a Star Trek episode.
Right.
And so I, even in eye surgery, seeing all the changes that I've seen just from being a patient family member to a part of the team, it's 10 times different. So what is it like, what do you see on the horizon for eye surgery? What do you think we're going to do more or less in the future?
So there is, and it's already started, more office-based surgery, OBS eye surgeries that are coming. Some people are huge fans of it. Some people not so much. And I think it truly matters, or it impacts you based on your demographic area where you're at. We here in Central Georgia, and at the practice I grew up in, we have a lot of glaucoma and a lot of severe glaucoma, and some of those procedures you wouldn't be able to do in the office. They're just a little more invasive.
And glaucoma has a lot to do with I guess diabetes also, and diabetic patients are more susceptible to having glaucoma. And I wonder, it'd be interesting to see if there was a correlation for that too. Like what other systemic or chronic health problems your patients are going through that a secondary thing is intraocular procedure issues too.
And I think, I mean, there's lots of different things that causes glaucoma. You have narrow angle glaucoma, which is anatomical. Just a family history is the most prominent thing of glaucoma. It could be the size, or like people who, like when you said retinal tear, people that have a longer eye or an axial length of 25 or higher, you know, on that higher end, they have a longer eye, which makes them more susceptible to a retinal tear, or retinal detachment.
Awesome.
So like we used to not do silicone lenses in those people in case something happened and they needed to go back, retina needed to go back and put silicone oil, whatever.
What are those kind of congenital issues when it comes to glaucoma? Are certain people's anatomically more susceptible to glaucoma?
Yeah, I just think glaucoma is a weird thing, right? Because there's no cure and everybody responds different. You know, you can have phacomorphic glaucoma, you can have narrow angle glaucoma, you can have just regular primary open angle glaucoma. And basically it's just the functioning of the aqueous fluid that flows from the front of the eye to the back of the eye. Mm-hmm. So if that fluid is just not channeling properly due to anatomical reasons, but the reason, to me, the biggest factor is just the family history of glaucoma.
Right.
And the best thing you can do is get your annual eye exams. And if you know you have any kind of family history, just go get it checked. Get your visual fields. Treat it when it's mild and moderate. Don't wait till it gets so bad. And I'm going to tell you, the eye drops are annoying. You know, and they're expensive. And it's unfortunate. But again, you have to remind people, these are your eyes.
Yeah.
Okay. Patch one eye for 2 days. Or one day. And think about if you don't take care of this now in 5 years or 10 years, or it could be 3 years, it could progress so bad that now that's how your every day will be. And sometimes you got to put
so
people,
many things for granted.
Yeah. And they say, oh, well, the eye drops are so expensive. Well, there's new things that are out. There's Durystas, which are little, almost like pledgets that take 2 seconds to put in the eye that we just do in the, you can do them in the office, you know, with numbing drops and put it in, and it'll help decrease your eye pressure. So you don't have to substitute for drops. There's a lot of options out there for people. People have to ask. And I will tell somebody, if you're going to an optometrist, please know an optometrist is not an ophthalmologist.
Yes. What is the difference for those who
glasses and contacts? Go see an ophthalmologist for anything else.
Yeah.
And even if you want a second opinion, go see another ophthalmologist. If you don't like what you hear, and I tell that to patients all the time, my friends that talk to me about, oh, I went to the doctor, this is what they said. I'm like, maybe you should go ask somebody else.
Yeah.
I mean, I do it with my own surgeries. I mean, I had Lapiplasty bunionectomy done, and people are like, oh, why didn't you just go to somebody local? I traveled 2 hours to find my surgeon. And I was like, because you got to do your research.
Yeah. I just went to a seminar on, and there were two surgeons that spoke about bunionectomies, and their approach was completely different. It was like it was a more medial and approach and proximal approach to the, for the bone than the distal approach that we used, I think traditionally.
Yeah,
this isn't about bunions, right? The wrong episode, but.
Yeah, I know. Next episode, I mean, we'll talk about that. Girl, I could go on about my feet.
Approaches. Yeah, there's so many you have to advocate for yourself. I love that you encourage people to do that, because that at the end of the day, you consent to what's being done to you. You want to make people educated.
And that's a big thing just in our country in general, right? I mean, you have to know your value as a human being and what you're worth. And it's okay to speak up. I mean, what are they going to do to you?
Nobody's ever died from the word no.
Right, exactly. And even with your eyes, I mean, if you're scheduled for cataract surgery and you're doing them close together to get it out of the way or whatever, but your first eye is not feeling so great, say something. Some people think, heck, I did it with a crown I had one time. I was like, it was kind of bothering me. And I was like, I have a high pain tolerance. I was like, oh, it's probably just normal. Never had it before. And I was inflaming my root because it was just bothering me, and I should have been doing something about it.
Yeah.
But tell people that if you don't feel comfortable with one, let's not move forward. Sure. Or, and even if circulating nurses watch this, ask your patient before you roll them to the room, how's your other eye doing?
Yeah.
And if they're not comfortable, you need to stop what you're doing right there. And if they're not happy, and you need to go tell the surgeon, because they may need to postpone it and they may need to recheck to make sure something's not going on. Because typically, like if someone has a high pressure after surgery in one eye, it's most likely that it's going to happen that way in the second eye, and it needs to be notated so we can address it intraoperatively or preoperatively or right after.
Take a different approach. for sure.
Right. And ask, and that's the thing that makes me sad too. I just had this conversation at work about the nurses that also make these post-op calls for these patients. Mm-hmm. And if a patient says, oh, I have a headache, but I mean, it's okay, but you know, it's scratchy. Okay. Scratchy is dry, you know, use more eye drops, your right. tears. But if you got a headache, if they ever say headache or feel kind of sick, they need to come in.
Because that's a pressure issue. Possibly.
It's a pressure issue.
Yeah.
And you can have a pressure spike. And if they, it depends on that surgeon's post-op protocol when they come back.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be bad for them. It could really do some damage. And what's the worst thing going to do? The clinic gets mad because you told a patient to come back to check them. Okay, let them get mad. I was doing what's best for the patient. I'd rather be safe than sorry.
Yeah, and you'll sleep better at night knowing that ultimately absolutely. You did the right thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And this, like I said, that goes for anybody in the medical field. But your eyes are your eyes. And I tell people, treat everybody like they're your mama or your kid's eyes. If this was your yes. kid having surgery, how would you want them to be treated? I mean, that's how we're supposed to treat people no matter how long we do it.
And also, that's how we're supposed to treat people just in general.
Like, correct.
Like, we could get into the humanistic approach for everything, but ultimately, just treat people how you want to be treated, the golden rule.
Absolutely.
Leave each other, give each other a little dadgum grace.
Right? Yes.
Yes. Katie, I have absolutely loved this. I feel like we went on so many tangents, but I think that was exactly the way that it was supposed to be.
Me too. Yeah. I feel like I could talk to you forever. I really enjoyed this. You made my morning.
Oh, thank you. I want to give you the last word. And the question I want to ask is, we have those students that might be listening, or we have those techs that may be thinking, I kind of want to change. And eyes are out there. Our eye surgery centers need techs just like everyone else does. And so why should they? Like, tell them why this is a career field or an option for them and why it matters.
I said it earlier, but of course our sight is one of our 5 God-given senses. And I will tell you that if the benefit of having your patients awake is that I can't tell you how many times a patient, we've taken the drapes off and turned the room lights on and moved the microscope over, and they start crying because they can see for the first time, sometimes in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And we had a patient fly from Ukraine to see Dr. Gayton one time, and we did bilateral dense white cataract removal. And I mean, it broke your heart to see that this poor woman had been blind so long because nobody would touch her. And if you want to be involved in something that's life-changing, because your vision is life-changing, whether you have it or you don't have it, this is a great area to go into. Because you do get that instant satisfaction that you never get in any other service. Because they do wake up and they say, oh my God, thank you so much. I can see. Oh my God. You know, I mean, you can do the finger game. And majority of the time, they'll be able to see. And it's just instant gratification that, okay, I'm doing something good for the world, for this person. And that in itself is a huge number one for me. 2, I think that going into any subspecialty area or super specialized area sets you apart. If you are one of those people that you don't want to be mediocre, you want to be excellent, and you want to be at the top of the field, and you want to challenge because not a lot of people want to take it on, this ophthalmic surgery is a world that you can definitely succeed in and thrive in, and you can make your mark. I want people to remember my name. You know, I don't want to just be, oh, that eye girl. And they're going to be like, Katie Mayo. Oh, yeah. We remember her. Little spitfire questioning us all the time.
Warn me when she's coming in the room.
That's right. But I want that. I want to leave a legacy of what I wanted to do and what I did. That's what we have a life for. We live it. We breathe it. We want to feel proud at the end of the day. And most of our patients are geriatric. So that's, you hear it from them. Live your life. Do something that makes you happy, do something that makes you proud, and you got to do it. And you can definitely earn that and get that in eyes. And you get to move around a little bit more. You don't get stuck 8 hours in one case. right?
Right. You know? It's fast paced. Nobody will argue with that.
It is fast paced, but it's good. You get to ebb and flow. You get to move around. You get to switch, and it's good. It's enjoyable. It can be very fun, and it's a field that you can excel in if you want to. Definitely a high choice for me.
I think fun definitely describes this last hour, and I'm so happy to know you. You are leaving a mark, and you are making a difference, and people will know your name. And so thank you for sharing your story and for being so passionate and encouraging to, and I hope that this opens others' eyes. And that they consider saying yes when asked.
Yes. And I thank you so much for having me on. I'm so grateful that Jason introduced me to you. And without people in our network of scrub techs and being able to reach out to people who can better ourselves, and we all want to keep that same positive energy and recognition and strength, I think that is just so amazing. And I'm just more than grateful to have met you and everybody else I've met along the way.
It's so good. And shout out to Jason Bonavito.
Yes.
Rock star in his own right.
Yes, he is. Classic king.
We have to give him some credit.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. I look forward to having you back for sure.
Yes, I can't wait for the next time.
Very cool.
All right, have a great day.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Scrub Life podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Scrub Life Podcast. Show notes for this episode, as well as past episodes, our contact information, and the virtual suggestion box can be found at our webpage, thescrublifepodcast.com. This has been Chris Blevins and Stephanie Austin with The Scrub Life Podcast. Until next time, be safe, support each other, and stay sterile.